Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. And so let's kind of get together so we can talk about some physiology. Can I have your attention? Great. Okay. So next time, there's no lecture. And because you have a test on chapters 12 and 13, right? 12 and 13 next time. So bring, what are you going to bring? Okay. Scantron, ID, pencil, most importantly, good eraser, check your erasers to make sure that they work before you take the test. Some students got gypped out of points because I no longer allow for smudges to be on the Scantron. So if you make a mark on your Scantron and you don't erase it properly and the Scantron reader marks it wrong, that's just the way it is. Okay? So make sure your eraser works. All right. That's good. So we're going to proceed with chapter 14 today. Some students did come to me and ask how come they can't scale this figure, this exam figure, properly in their computer, which is a JPEG, and it prints out on four pieces of paper. And I didn't put it back into Photoshop and rescale it and then put it back up on the web. So what I did instead is I just made a photocopy with the questions and the answer key on the backside. So why don't you take one? If you do not need one, don't take one. All right, pass that around, because guess what this is? That's an exam figure. But even more importantly, it's some knowledge that you should have, that you should have for the rest of your life, right? So make sure you practice it, because well, it could be on the exam. What is it? It's the cardiac cycle. Is it on the exam? It will be on the exam every day for the rest of your life. Yes. Okay. So that is important. Very important information for you to know. All right. Any other comments or questions? Comments, questions? You're ready to go? Okay. So we're going to start. This is pretty much where we left off, which I think is pretty close to slide number one. And there's a button around here that says start the slideshow. All right, so this is what we were working on last time when we quit. We're trying to define what speed is. What is speed? Speed is the same thing as velocity, which is what you have on your speedometer inside your car. Right, that's how they name that thing, speedometer. Oh, yeah, I'm not projecting this, so you have to just look at the board. Speedometer, and what are the units of speed or velocity? It is equal to distance traveled per what? Per unit time. All right, so that would be, what's a good measure of distance? Miles, okay, for instance in your car, miles per hour. That would be your speed, miles per hour. Or you could say another unit would be maybe centimeters per second, or let's say centimeters per minute. All right, centimeters per minute, that would still be what? Speed or velocity. And in physiology, we're interested in that sometimes. But in cardiovascular system, more times than not, we're interested in flow. So what's the difference between flow compared to speed? Right, flow is, the units are volume per time. So the amount of material that's moving per time through maybe just a doorway. All right, then that could be just a very, very small distance. So what's a good measure of volume? Would be cubic centimeters, which would be a milliliter, right? So we're going to say milliliter per time, and let's just say minute, because that's the time frame we're going to look at in terms of the heart. All right, milliliters per minute. And guess what produces that flow for us? That would be the heart, right? The heart pumps blood, and we can measure that in terms of milliliter per minute. And that's a blood flow, and sometimes we call that cardiac output. All right, cardiac output. So that's one of the important parameters that we're going to look at today, is cardiac output from the heart, and that's a flow. And so on the screen, you see two parameters that, oh, that's right, this thing, that's right, I'm sorry. I got to do something. I'm going to leave it like that so I don't forget that it's ready to chop somebody's fingers off right there. Okay, cardiac output. What are the two parameters that we use to determine cardiac output? But don't forget, what's cardiac output? It is, it's really flow. It's blood flow. All right, so cardiac output. And what are the units of cardiac output? It's going to be milliliters per minute, right? Those are the units. Cardiac output is going to be determined by your heart rate. All right, that's HR times the stroke volume. All right, and the units of heart rate is, maybe I should kind of put that in there. What are the units of heart rate? It is, yeah, beats per minute. And is that easy to measure? In a healthy person, it is, because you can take a carotid artery pulse or radial artery pulse, right, or a pedal pulse and figure out somebody's heart rate very easily, times the stroke volume. And the stroke volume is the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats. Right? So the heart is not pumping blood when it's not beating. What do we call it when the heart is beating? When it's contracting. That's on that slide that I'm passing around. That's systole. And when the heart is in relaxation, what do we call that? That's diastole. Okay? All right. So stroke volume is in the units of milliliters per beat. Every time the heart beats, it pumps out some blood. And now, do the units match up to where we think it should be for cardiac output? Yeah, because the beats cancel out and you're left with milliliters per minute, right? So we now can calculate cardiac output. Now, how do we think about this in our minds? What's the relationship between cardiac output and heart rate? Cardiac output and stroke volume. What's the relationship? How do we talk about that mathematically? It's directly proportional, or you could say directly related, which means, right, because cardiac output is equal to everything that's in the numerator over here. There's nothing in the denominator. So everything is directly related to it. So if heart rate goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up. Has to, because of this relationship. What about stroke volume? If it goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It's got to go up. All right, and if both heart rate and stroke volume go up, then of course cardiac output even goes up faster. All right, now, what about if heart rate goes down? What happens to cardiac output? It goes down, right? It goes in the same direction. That's why we say it's directly related. All right, so those are two important parameters that we're going to be looking at in this chapter pretty extensively. And in lab, I think you looked at blood flow through a tube. Blood flow through a tube. And there was a pretty cool equation that described blood flow through a tube, which we're going to get into in this chapter, but I just want to introduce that concept to you. How do you describe blood flow through a tube? What affects blood flow through a tube? All right, so that's what I'm going to work on over here. You find things in the numerator, things in the denominator. What kinds of things relate directly to flow of fluid through a tube? Pressure, right. As the pressure goes up, what happens to flow? That kind of makes sense, right? As you increase the pressure, you're going to get more flow through that tube, right? So in the numerator, we've got pressure. I'm just going to show that as a P, okay? But you also learn some things that slow flow down. Even if we were to hold pressure constant, some things can slow blood flow down or fluid flow through that tube. The radius. Very important. We're going to look at that in this chapter quite a bit. What else will slow the flow down? Viscosity. Okay. All of those terms go into something that we call resistance. All right. So that was Poiseuille's equation. And Poiseuille expanded all of these little resistive terms right here. All right, so that if resistance goes up, what happens to flow? It goes down because resistance is inversely related to flow. Pressure, on the other hand, is directly related to flow. So I'm going to be using those terms in this lecture. So this is just a nice simple equation that describes the relationship between pressure, resistance, and flow. And now we're going to relate that to the cardiovascular system over the next week or so, because I can't finish this chapter today. All right, so those are some of the things. Unfortunately, in this kind of class, sometimes it takes a couple days to cover a particular topic, so you can't understand everything all in just one lecture. All right, so here is cardiac output. We just talked about all these different parameters. How would you describe the relationship between cardiac output and stroke volume? Directly related, right? Directly related to it. Okay. All right, regulation of chronotropy of the heart. What does chronotropy refer to? What does chrono mean? It means time. So it has to do with the timing of the heart, not force of contraction. So this relates to heart rate. So in this equation right here, what term are we specifically looking at? Heart rate, which means what? We're actually looking at the influence of these things on cardiac output, because heart rate partly determines the cardiac output. Okay. So without neuronal influences, that SA node will drive the heart at a rate corresponding to its spontaneous activity. So the SA node, what do we call the SA node? Because it controls the heart rhythm. That's the pacemaker of the heart, right? It depolarizes spontaneously. It has its own inherent autorhythmicity. As a matter of fact, all nodal cells in the heart, and maybe even the contractile cells of the heart, can show or exhibit autorhythmicity, but the SA node is especially important because it depolarizes the soonest compared to all of the other kinds of tissues in the heart. All right. So normally, sympathetic and parasympathetic activity influence heart rate or influence the chronotropic effect on the heart. So the heart will beat by itself without innervation, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark put somebody's heart on the table right there. It's going to beat, but in your body, right, your heart is going to want to beat by itself, but it's the job of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system to control the rhythm. It influences the rhythm. All right, so as a matter of fact, you can tell me what the relationship is between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system on the heart. They are antagonistic to each other, which is okay, because when you have antagonistic control systems, what does that provide for that mechanism? Balance and precise control, right? So you need to have both of those. We're going to see a little variation of this theme in just a second. All right, so the autonomic innervation, namely what? Sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation of the SA node is the main controller of heart rate. So the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve fibers modify the rate of that spontaneous depolarization. Now, can you picture an action potential of a nodal cell and what it looked like? Does it have a plateau? No, it doesn't have a plateau. Does it have a stable resting membrane potential? No, it's got a resting membrane potential that slowly depolarizes because of certain channels in the membrane. What kind of channels did we call those? Those were the HCN channels. The HCN channels, which are sodium channels that will always be a little bit leaky. They will leak sodium from high, and sodium will go from high to low. Where's sodium high? Outside. Am I talking too fast? Can you hear me today? Oh, I'm not wearing the microphone. I knew there was something. All right, I don't want to take time. If I can figure out when to put it on, I'll do it. But sodium channels. Where's sodium high? Outside the cell. So when a sodium channel opens up, what happens? It goes in. And when sodium goes in, what do we call that? Or what does that cause is a better way of asking. Depolarization, which is what? An excitatory event, right? Because that drives the membrane potential toward threshold for producing an action potential. Okay, so here we have action potentials. Three different cases right here. And if you were to look at this action potential, you could tell me if that is a contractile cell or a nodal cell inside the heart. Is that true? Could you tell me or not? You should be able to. I agree, you should be able to. And indeed, what kind of action potential is that? That's a nodal cell, right? Because there's no plateau phase produced by those calcium channels. So here are nodal fibers. All right, so after repolarization, there's no stable resting membrane potential. Sodium channels open up, allow sodium to enter the cell, and it slowly depolarizes. And then when it reaches threshold, an action potential is produced, and that triggers a heartbeat. Now, how can that trigger a heartbeat if this one cell, even one cell in the SA node, depolarizes like this? Because there are electrical synapses between all the heart cells. Because the intercalated discs have one component that we call a gap junction. So basically, you only need one cell to trigger the whole heart to produce action potentials. And then, because of excitation-contraction coupling, then you have what the cross bridges forming and the shrinking of sarcomeres throughout the whole heart, causing the heart to contract. Okay. But notice that we have three different curves right here, all starting at about 50 millivolts. Okay. And under sympathetic innervation, all right, notice the slope of this region right here, which kind of looks like raspberry color or something to me. What color is that? Like a reddish kind of color? Notice the slope or the angle of this slow depolarization. It speeds up, right? There are more HCN channels that open up, so more sodium can enter the cell. So this depolarization is faster, which means it reaches threshold at a sooner time, a sooner place in time, so we get a heart beat much sooner compared to a resting condition. All right? And so notice in the same period of time under kind of resting conditions, right, or control conditions, or you might want to say baseline conditions, sometimes people use that term. What happened to the heart rate under sympathetic stimulation? How many beats did you get for this period of time compared to control? You'd get 3 beats versus 2, so the heart rate sped up with sympathetic innervation to the SA node. Okay. And how would you describe that? How did that happen? Because the slope of this spontaneous depolarization is much steeper under sympathetic stimulation. All right. Let's look at a second case over here. All right, actually it's the third case. Under parasympathetic stimulation, all right, when what the neurotransmitter is released on the heart from parasympathetic postganglionic fibers? Acetylcholine, okay? When acetylcholine is placed on the heart, that opens potassium channels. And what do potassium channels do? They will inhibit depolarization. Right, so that slows down the rate of depolarization of this part of the membrane potential. All right, so it takes longer to reach threshold, and then when it reaches threshold, you get a normal depolarization and action potential just like usual. All right, but because the slope is a lot less, all right, look what happens to the heart rate. How many beats of the heart do we see under parasympathetic stimulation? Only one, because it takes longer to reach threshold. Okay. So again, we want to relate control of heart rate to sodium and potassium channels and how they are influenced by acetylcholine. And I tell you what is a neurotransmitter by the postganglionic sympathetic neuron? That's norepinephrine. Okay, so relate ion channels to the specific effects of acetylcholine and norepinephrine controlling the chronotropy of the heart, okay, which is relating to what? That's the rate, the rhythm of the heart, which is an important participant in understanding something about cardiac output. So that would be a really good question. I could, like a written question I could ask, like, describe the nature of the ion channels in controlling cardiac output of the heart. Okay, so you would think of what? Heart rate of the SA node. And as heart rate increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases as well. Okay. All right, so that's the heart rate. So both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves go to the SA node to control heart rate. All right, what is another concept, or what's another way that the heart can be controlled? Not just by adjusting the rhythm, but the force of contraction. And guess which term in cardiac output that relates to? Stroke volume, right? The force of contraction relates to stroke volume over here. So heart rate refers to chronotropy, right? And contractility refers to inotropy of the heart. And they're kind of independent from each other. There's ways to regulate these independently from each other. Your body does. All right, so sometimes when we say contractility, or when we say force of contraction, we're just talking about contractility. And there is a center in the medulla called the cardiac control unit, or actually I like to call it the cardioregulatory center, which is in the medulla, and that coordinates the activity of the autonomic nervous system, especially the sympathetic nervous system. And these sympathetic fibers go to the atria as well as the ventricles. Now, where did we, when we talked about chronotropy on the heart, where did the nerve fibers go to? What parts of the heart? If we look back over here, what part of the heart were we talking about? Ventricles, the atria, and in particular, the SA node, right? So in terms of regulating heart rate, it just goes to the SA node, but in terms of regulating the force of contraction, we're talking about nerve endings that go to the atria and the ventricles as well. Okay. And so they stimulate increased force of contraction of the heart. And as the contractility increases, guess what happens to stroke volume? They're directly related. As the heart becomes stronger, the stroke volume increases, the heart can pump more blood out. Okay, and then what's the effect on cardiac output? It goes up as well, right, because it's directly related. Okay, so here is a pretty nice table that shows the effects of the autonomic nervous system on the heart. Okay, we got sympathetic versus parasympathetic, and we have a couple different spots. SA node. If we stimulate the SA node, is that going to have an effect on the chronotropy of the heart or the inotropy of the heart? Chronotropy. It's not going to affect force of contraction. It's just going to control heart rate. But is that important for controlling cardiac output? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Okay, so we have both sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves that go to the SA node. Right, but they're antagonistic in nature, right? So you can appreciate that. Also, both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves increase and or decrease the conduction rate through the AV node. Where's that AV node at? Did we talk about that in the last chapter? I think we talked about the conduction system a little bit. Oh yeah, we did. That's the only pathway that electrical impulses can get through the fibrous myocardium between the atria and the ventricles. And sympathetic stimulation or increasing sympathetic tone speeds the rate of transmission through the fibrous myocardium, and parasympathetic slows the transmission of impulses through. So again, that's going to be what, an inotropic or a chronotropic effect on the heart by speeding up or slowing down the rate of impulse transmission through the fibrous myocardium. That's chronotropy, right? That's chronotropy. It's going to adjust heart rate. Is that important for determining cardiac output? Yeah, because, you see, they're directly related to each other. All right, now here is something a little strange. For the sympathetic nervous system, we have sympathetic nerves that go to the atrial muscle and ventricular muscle. But look over here at the parasympathetic nervous system. Are there parasympathetic nerves that go to the atrial myocardium and ventricular myocardium? There aren't. So the parasympathetic nervous system can have no effect on force of contraction because there are no nerves that go there. All right, so what's the inotropic effect of parasympathetic stimulation? Nothing. Has no effect whatsoever. But sympathetic, increasing sympathetic tone on the heart increases strength of contraction of both the atrium and the ventricular muscle. So in terms of inotropy of the heart, it's only sympathetic nerves that can play a role by increasing stroke volume. All right, so stroke volume can be determined by three important variables. The end diastolic volume, EDV, that's on that diagram that I just sent around. Okay, that, and what is the end diastolic volume? Is that the big volume of the, that's the big volume. That's when the heart is completely filled with blood, right, and it's stretched out. The resistance, that's the impedance to blood flow. So we can look at this equation right here. Where do we have resistance to flow in this equation? On the bottom over here. All right, so if the resistance to flow in your systemic or pulmonary circulation increases, that's going to impede the amount of flow that the heart can pump out. That's all there's to it, right? Because it's inversely related. As resistance increases, the flow from the heart is going to decrease. And then the second thing right here is myocardial contractility, which is what? Basically, inotropy of the heart, strength of ventricular contraction. All right, and some of these are related to each other, and that's what we're going to talk about for the next couple days, is the relationship between them. All right, the end-diastolic volume is really the workload on the heart. And I want you to kind of understand that, because if there's just a little bit of blood in the heart, okay, it's relatively easy to pump it out. But if there's a lot of blood in the heart, then the heart has to work a little bit harder to pump more blood out. Right? Consider I have a weight over here that I want over there, and I need some help from you guys to move this weight over there. What's harder to move? Like one 5-pound weight, or if I had like 25 5-pound weights? 25 would be a lot harder to move from one end to the other. Same thing for the heart, right? The workload increases as the end-diastolic volume increases prior to contraction, all right? But the stroke volume is directly related to the preload on the heart and contractility. This is the concept that we're going to work on next, all right? So that means if the stroke volume, all right, if this preload or workload goes up, what happens to stroke volume? Another way of asking is, if the end-diastolic volume increases as the workload gets harder, guess what happens to stroke volume? This is not intuitive. That's actually kind of counterintuitive. What happens to the contractility of the heart as you demand more work from the heart? What would be a good thing for the heart to be able to do? To respond and do the work without complaining. And that's what it does under most circumstances. When you give the heart more blood to pump, it just does its job and does it with a nice smile. And we're going to see the mechanism that's involved in that. All right, so strength of contraction relates directly with end-diastolic volume. So as the end-diastolic volume gets bigger, so does contractility. It gets bigger. All right, the resistance, which is what we call the afterload, that impedes the ejection of blood from the heart. As the heart has to pump more blood into the circulation, if the resistance is high, then it's going to take more energy to do that. And then here is an important term. We call this ejection fraction. And you all had to calculate and work with hematocrit a little bit. Can anybody remember what hematocrit was? Hematocrit, here we have a test tube. All right, here's the top. This represents whole blood. The whole blood sample. But if we centrifuge it, we can break blood down into plasma and formed elements, right? And in particular, if we just look at red blood cells right here, we can measure the percentage of red blood cells compared to the whole volume. And so that's just what? A percentage. That's just like the number, right, that you got on the test. All right, the percentage of red blood cells in a whole blood sample, that's what we call hematocrit. And what does it kind of look like? Is it 50%? Less than 50%? 40-something, right? Maybe 45%? That's, you know, fairly accurate. It's less than 50. So that's what hematocrit is. Ejection fraction is the same kind of concept, all right? It is stroke volume divided by end-diastolic volume. Well, what's end-diastolic volume? End-diastolic volume is the volume of the heart when it's relaxed. All right, and stroke volume is how much that's pumped out. And if you divide stroke volume, I can't draw it, I thought I could draw it. If you divide stroke volume by end-diastolic volume, you just get the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats. All right, that's the ejection fraction related to the initial size of the heart. And that's really an important number. It's a percentage. It's normally about 60%. Of the blood that fills up the heart during diastole gets pumped out. And as you start to go into heart failure, or you start to have leaky valves, guess what happens to that percentage, which is the ejection fraction? It decreases, right? And as you go into heart failure, it decreases more and more and more. And after a certain point in time, all right, if the ejection fraction is really, really low, we can never restore that heart back to function again. Even if we do a valve replacement or repair, right, or reperfuse the heart, it will never come back. So that ejection fraction is very important clinically for determining not only the outcome of surgery, but when we should operate on the heart. And you want to operate on the heart before the ejection fraction becomes too small. Otherwise, there's nothing we can do for a patient. All right, so that's why I want you to pay attention to ejection fraction. All right, so let's look at why we said stroke volume is directly proportional to the preload, which is what? End diastolic volume. Why is stroke volume, which is a measure of contractility, directly related to end diastolic volume of the heart? All right, so can you tell me, on a structural level, from an anatomical level, when we start to stretch out a heart, when it starts to fill with blood, what's happening to those sarcomeres inside the heart? Okay, yeah, they're relaxing. All right, and as the heart fills up, the sarcomeres are, the Z lines are moving farther apart from each other, and what's the relationship between actin and myosin then as the Z discs move far apart from each other? They're sliding past each other, right, in a way that is opposite of contraction. They start to stretch out past each other. And remember, we looked at the length-tension relationship in skeletal muscle way back when, and we said that muscles can perform at their optimum when a skeletal muscle is what? When a sarcomere is short or when it's partially stretched out. Yeah, and if you stretch it out too much, what happens to the overlap between actin and myosin? They don't overlap, and then the sarcomere is kind of worthless, right? So there is an optimal level of overlap between actin and myosin that can generate force. And in the heart, what describes that is the Frank-Starling law of the heart. So this is a real important law of the heart, which describes the resting length of a myocardial cell compared to the amount of tension that can be developed, but always related to the overlap of actin and myosin filaments. And so this is a way that we can measure, okay, let's measure stroke volume, right, versus end diastolic volume on the heart. That's what we're going to plot out right here. Okay. And what do we got? Stroke volume. What's a good way of thinking of stroke volume? What is that? What kind of inherent property is that? Yeah, stroke volume, inotropy is what? The rate of the heart or strength of contraction? Strength of contraction or force of contraction. So we're just going to look at force of contraction versus this end diastolic volume right here. So let's look at just this curve right on the bottom. Notice what happens to stroke volume as end diastolic volume increases on this diagram. Does it stay the same? Does it increase or decrease? It increases. All right, so this is actually a pretty marvelous nature of the heart. As the heart fills up with blood to a greater degree, what happens to contractility? It goes up. Okay, and this is what we call an intrinsic property of the heart. We don't need any kind of intervention from nerves or hormones or anything else. This is just a property of the heart, how it's put together or how the sarcomeres are put together. Okay, so as the heart stretches, the Frank-Starling law says the force of contraction increases that we see right here, which is a good thing, right? As you ask more of the heart to do, as you ask the heart to do more, it gets stronger. The force of contraction gets stronger. And that makes perfect sense. All right, so this graph over here also shows the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the ventricles. All right, so if we're increasing sympathetic stimulation, what's the difference between this curve on the bottom compared to this curve that's in the middle right here? At a particular end diastolic volume, I tell you what, let's pick the one right here right above the T in ventricular right here. All right, and if we pick the same end diastolic volume and look at these three different curves at three different levels of sympathetic stimulation, all right, can you see that the force of contraction increases as we increase the sympathetic stimulation? Even though we don't have numbers over here, can you see that this middle curve is contracting more strongly compared to the bottom curve? Even at the same end diastolic volume, it goes up. And if we increase sympathetic stimulation, look what happens. The stroke volume increases even at a constant end diastolic volume. So sympathetic stimulation increases the stroke volume or contractility of the heart. All right, so to explain that, right, we just want to look at the overlap of actin and myosin filaments. Here we have three different levels of overlap. Let's look on the right-hand slide, right-hand side of the slide right here. We got four different cases. Case A, we see a sarcomere. There's a lot of overlap between actin and myosin, but the Z-discs are almost butting up against the end of the myosin molecule right here. So even though we can get plenty of cross-bridge formation, right, and cross-bridge cycling, can this sarcomere get any shorter? It cannot, and since it can't get any shorter, it can't produce any tension as a result. All right, so that represents this curve on the bottom, curve A, which is a plot of tension versus time when we stimulate that muscle. If there's too much overlap, that heart muscle cell can produce hardly any tension whatsoever. All right, now let's separate the Z-discs a little bit. We still have plenty of overlap between actin and myosin, okay? But again, there's still very little distance that this sarcomere can shorten, but it can shorten a little bit, and it produces a little bit of tension. All right, let's stretch it a little bit more. And as we're stretching this sarcomere, what's happening to end diastolic volume? What's happening to end diastolic volume as we go from condition A all the way up to condition B? Yeah, end diastolic volume is going up, the heart is expanding during diastole, and the sarcomeres are stretching out. And then let's look maybe just at this last case, case D right here. There's still plenty of overlap between actin and myosin, but there is a lot of shortening that this sarcomere can go through to produce a lot of tension. All right, so this is the basis at this molecular level of the Frank-Starling law of the heart that says as end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to strength of contraction of the heart? It increases as well because you have optimal overlap of the actin and myosin myofilaments. All right. More importantly, I think I want to draw something on while we're talking about this. I want to draw something on the board really, really quick. I kind of like that black marker. That worked. Where did it go? Then over here. Okay. So here's the Frank-Starling law of the heart, the whole one. So what are we going to plot out? What are we going to plot out? Like, what's over here? Tension, force of contraction. All right, or you could say contractility if you wanted. Some people say that. Versus what down over here on the bottom? End diastolic volume, which is what? The amount that the ventricle stretches out. During what phase of the heart cycle? When does the heart stretch out? Systole or diastole? Why should I ask? What are the two phases of the heart cycle? Okay, that's during diastole. Here's the Frank-Starling law. Looks like that. Here is the ascending limb. Okay. Here is a kind of a plateau region and a descending limb. All right. So let's take a look at this over here. When might somebody's heart be operating in this descending limb of the Frank-Starling curve? When does your heart not fill up with blood? It's going to be a pathological condition. Like you get into an automobile accident and you lacerate your femoral artery or carotid artery and you got all this blood pumping out of your body, leaving your body. So if the blood is running down the pavement, does it have a chance to get back to the heart? No, it doesn't. You're losing blood volume because of hemorrhage. So if blood can't get back to the heart, what happens to end diastolic volume? It starts to plummet. Okay? So now what happens to stretching of the heart? The heart doesn't stretch out, but here's the really terrible thing. Because of that intrinsic property of the heart, just when you need the heart to kick in and start pumping more blood because you're losing it, what happens to the force of the heart? It starts to go down, right? So that's a terrible situation, right? You end up in cardiovascular shock, and it's really easy to die under these circumstances because you're losing blood, but not only that, you're losing heart function. Your heart is actually losing the ability to contract during this ascending limb of the Frank-Starling curve. But paramedics can show up, and what can they do? Well, they can stop the bleeding, but what else can they do? They can actually start to transfuse, not blood, because they didn't do a cross match and blood typing on you like you guys are experts in doing right now. They can at least hook an IV and start to pump salt water, right, a normal saline solution into your blood, and then your blood volume goes up. What does that do? That helps fill the heart back up. Even if it's salt water, that helps fill the heart back up. What does that do to end diastolic volume? The end diastolic volume goes back up, and where do you start to move on this Frank Starling curve? You move up the Frank Starling curve, so what happens to contractility of the heart? It's restored. So now you can get some blood flow to essential organs in your body just by transfusing somebody that's what we call hypovolemic, all right, because they're hemorrhaging. So is that cool? I think that's pretty cool to understand how that happens. All right, that's the ascending limb. All right, so that's condition A, hemorrhage. Now over here, this explains something else too. And this is when, what happens to the size of your heart on this descending limb of the Frank Starling curve? Your heart gets what? Bigger and bigger and bigger. This happens with hypertension, when somebody has high blood pressure, and when they go into heart failure, their heart gets really, really big. Term is escaping me at the moment, all right? Yeah, it's hypertrophy of the left ventricle. It gets really, dilated cardiomyopathy. Dilated cardiomyopathy. Somebody's ventricles get really, really big. And what's the problem with that? Right, when you're on this descending limb, as your ventricles start to expand too much, what happens to contractility? It starts to go down. All right? And so stroke volume continues to go up. The heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker because there's too much fluid in the ventricles. What can we do to somebody that's in congestive heart failure? Anybody? Hopefully not too many family members in congestive heart failure, but one of the first treatments is a diuretic. What does a diuretic do? It gets rid of water from your body. You pee all that water out of your body. What happens to end diastolic volume then? It starts to go down. What happens to contractility? It goes back up. So sometimes it's pretty easy to pull somebody out of heart failure just by giving a diuretic because you understand this Frank Starling law of the heart. All right, so is that pretty cool over here, too, to see that? All right, so Frank Starling law is really important because it shows you how we treat different patients under different conditions. All right, but it also kind of underscores the importance of a certain kind of control of the heart. What did we call that kind of control? Intrinsic or extrinsic? It's intrinsic. It's just a property of the heart by itself. Right, so you don't have to worry about sympathetic nerves or parasympathetic nerves or anything. You're just concerned about end diastolic volume, and that relates to how much blood is flowing back to the heart during diastole. So that kind of also underscores how important diastolic function of the heart is. We have to appreciate how the heart relaxes and fills. That's just as important as how important the heart contracts during systole. Right, so both phases of the heart cycle are important. All right, that's the Frank Starling law. Okay, extrinsic control of contractility. Again, we're going to be looking at stroke volume right here. All right, at any given end diastolic volume, contraction depends on the sympathetic tone that's applied to the heart. That's due to sympathetic nerves, but where else can sympathetic information How else can sympathetic information signal the heart? Besides sympathetic nerves, where else can it come from? You have to think of your autonomic nervous system. There was one special organ that was kind of mimicking the postganglionic neuron, even though it's not a neuron, the adrenal medulla, right? When it's stimulated, it releases epinephrine and norepinephrine, a little bit of norepinephrine into the blood, which is like what? Sympathetic nerve stimulation. All right, it increases heart rate because it acts on the SA node, all right, but it also is a positive inotropic agent because it increases calcium within the sarcomeres when it's released. All right, and calcium is important, all right, for cross-bridge cycling. It moves what? What does it bind to? What does calcium bind to? Troponin, and then it moves tropomyosin out of the way so you can get cross bridges to form, right? So that increases contractility. Well, here we have a plot of tension versus muscle length, okay? And we have a couple of conditions. We got some heart muscle here and here, and then we have some skeletal muscle over here just for comparison, right? If we have heart muscle without epinephrine, right, look at the end-diastolic volume. It has to be up near 90% of optimum, right, to develop all, a measurable amount of tension. But under sympathetic or under, yeah, under as we increase sympathetic tone, we increase epinephrine or norepinephrine, look, this curve shifts to the left, which means at any end-diastolic volume, it will produce more force, right? So when you shift to the left, when we shift these curves to the left, is that a positive inotropic effect or a negative inotropic effect as you shift a curve to the left? Which is asking, at any end-diastolic volume, as you shift the curve to the left, does it produce more or less tension in the heart? All right, so it's going to be here versus here. Case one versus two, which case produces more tension at a constant end-diastolic volume? Case number two, which means that this curve is what? Shifting to the left. That's what increasing sympathetic tone does on the heart. And where does that control signal come from? Does it come from inside the heart or from outside the heart? It comes from sympathetic nerves or the adrenal medulla, which is outside the heart. So is that intrinsic or extrinsic control? That's extrinsic control. So the heart can be controlled both through intrinsic mechanisms and extrinsic mechanisms. Both are very important. All right, so let's take a look at this little diagram right here that shows us cardiac output being directly related to cardiac output and stroke volume. And if we think of, cardiac output directly related to cardiac rate or heart rate and stroke volume. So what effect, how would you talk about the effect on cardiac rate or heart rate? What kind of effect is that? Chronotropic. And what's the effect on stroke volume? That's inotropy on the heart, right? So we got chronotropy and inotropy right here. The solid lines represent, right, a positive effect, and a dashed line represents a negative effect, right, or inhibitory. All right, so parasympathetic nerves, where do they go? To the heart. What parts of the heart do they go to? They only go to the SA node. And what's the SA node responsible for? That's the pacemaker adjusting the heart rate. What kind of effect is that? That's a chronotropic effect. And you see parasympathetic nerves go anywhere over here to affect stroke volume. Nope, because it doesn't go to any muscle. It just goes to the nodal tissues. All right, so that's the only effect of the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, now don't forget, sympathetic nerves go both to the SA node, AV node 2. Don't forget about the AV node. All right, but it also goes to the muscle cells. And what does stimulating, increasing sympathetic activity on contraction? It increases force of contraction, right? And as the heart gets stronger, that increases stroke volume, right? So sympathetic nerves are, what's the effect on stroke volume? How would we classify that effect? Sympathetic stimulation on stroke volume. Is that positive or negative? It's positive because it's a solid line. But it's positive because it will do what? It will increase stroke volume. So it's a positive inotropic effect on the heart. Okay? All right. That's sympathetic and parasympathetic stimulation. Now, let's talk about, and what kind of control is parasympathetic and sympathetic stimulation on the heart? What kind of control is that? Intrinsic or extrinsic? That's extrinsic. So that's part of it. What's another part should you appreciate? If we just looked at extrinsic, what's another part? The intrinsic. And what law tells us about the intrinsic control of the heart? Frank Starling law. Okay. All right, so as you stretch the ventricles, what happens to end-diastolic volume? It increases, right? And the strength of contraction increases. What happens to stroke volume then? It increases as well. All right, so that's what you see right here. And let's look over here at this one last remaining item. Mean arterial pressure. What's the effect of mean arterial pressure on stroke volume? What the heck was mean arterial pressure? Let's just say we've got two walls in this room. We've got like a little paper wall on a frame right over here. Sometimes you use it as a room divider. Just standing right here. Can you picture like a little room divider? What do you call those things that kind of fold out? Little partition, okay. That's one kind of wall. And then we got like a wall over here. So if I walk up to the little room divider and I push very, very lightly on that, I'll be able to knock it over. All right. What happens if I push the same way on this wall over here? Will I knock it over? No. Because that wall exhibits more pressure compared to this one over here. So as the pressure increases, what about blood flow leaving the heart? It takes more energy to pump blood into an artery that's high in pressure compared to low in pressure. Okay? And so that's what this means. As blood pressure increases, stroke volume is going to go down. The heart has to work harder to pump blood from a ventricle into an artery when there is high pressure in that artery. And what the heck did we call that? We call that the afterload. That's what we call afterload, if you go back to that first slide. Okay. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about venous return and how important that is. Venous return just means blood returning to the heart from veins, and you should be able to relate to that a little bit already. Okay. When does venous return occur in the heart cycle? When does it mostly occur? And I want you to really think of a ventricle right now. When does venous return occur in the heart cycle? What are the two phases of a heart cycle? Systole and diastole. So when can blood return to the heart? During systole or diastole? Diastole, right? It's a filling part. And you got to fill in that diagram, don't forget. Make sure you see when blood flows back. And the volume of the ventricle does what during diastole? It expands, right? And you can see that on the curve that we passed out. Okay, so venous return is an important diastolic function of the heart. All right, so venous return is return of blood to the heart via veins, of course, because that's the definition of vein. And that controls end diastolic volume. Of course, the heart is going to expand. And of course, then that controls stroke volume. All right, that controls stroke volume on the heart. How does end diastolic volume control stroke volume? What's the law? The law that says that. That's the Frank Starling law, intrinsic property of the heart. As end diastolic volume goes up, usually we're operating in this region over here, stroke volume increases. And how is stroke volume related to cardiac output? Directly related. So if stroke volume goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up as well. All right, so I know this might seem a little bit complicated, but once you look at it a couple times and you get your notes written down, all right, you'll get in the flow of how this works. All right, so that's why we can say venous return controls end diastolic volume, and because of that, it controls stroke volume, and because of that, that controls cardiac output of the heart, blood flow from the heart. Now, there might not be anybody in here that can really follow that statement at the moment, but go ahead, raise your hand if you have like a glimmer of hope. Anybody have a glimmer of hope to understand that? Sort of? Okay, good. Okay, it is possible. All right, so what is venous return dependent on? Blood volume and venous pressure. All right, we talked about blood volume. If you're in a hemorrhage situation, you don't have blood to return to the heart. Venous return, what happens to venous return under hemorrhage? It drops. What happens to stroke volume? It drops. Cardiac output drops. All right? Okay, that's a good start. All right. Vasoconstriction caused by increasing sympathetic tone. Okay? This is true. Venous return. A lot of our blood vessels, especially veins, are very dilated. They're huge. They're cavernous. And when we have sympathetic stimulation, our veins have a tendency to constrict. And guess what happens to all that blood? Instead of being stuck in the venous blood system, it's returned really to the cardiovascular system so that it can circulate. So as veins constrict, guess where that blood goes? Because veins have valves, it doesn't go to your extremities. That blood goes to your heart. And as that blood goes to your heart, what happens to the ventricles? They expand, they fill up, end-diastolic volume goes up. That means contractility of the heart goes up, so the cardiac output goes up. So vasoconstriction caused by increasing sympathetic tone generally has a good positive influence on heart function. All right, what else happens? What else is a way to get blood back to the heart? We talked about this. How does venous blood normally return to the heart? Two pumps that are involved. Skeletal muscle pump, just by using skeletal muscle, that helps return blood to the heart. And the respiratory pump, right? By decreasing pressure inside your thorax, that kind of acts like a vacuum cleaner, sucking blood up into your thorax. And guess where your heart is? It's in your thorax, right? So that helps return blood to the heart. Okay. So here is probably an exam figure for the last test. I'm not really certain, but I would guess. All right. What about blood volume? How does your body, or how can it adjust blood volume? All right. By adjusting urine output. What organ adjusts urine output? The kidney. So your kidney has an important function on your cardiovascular system. All right. And as your urine volume increases, what happens to blood volume? That fluid's got to come from someplace. Your blood volume decreases. So as urine output goes up, blood volume decreases. All right? And as your blood volume decreases, what happens to venous return? Okay, it decreases. And then end-diastolic volume decreases. Right? And that could have a negative influence on the heart depending on where you are in that Frank Starling curve. What about breathing? Breathing decreases thoracic pressure that allows more blood to enter the thorax, that increases venous return, that increases end-diastolic volume. That helps heart function. Okay, and this is the first topic that we talked about. Sympathetic stimulation causes venoconstriction that constricts veins, which then increases blood, that helps pump blood to the heart to increase venous return. Right, which then increases end-diastolic volume, and that helps cardiac output. Same thing for the skeletal muscle pump. Okay. All right, so veins, well, we just said, some veins can be very dilated under normal circumstances if you're not under high levels of sympathetic stimulation. Right, veins hold most of the blood in the body, about 70%. So we call these capacitance blood vessels. Remember, veins have very thin walls. They stretch very easily to accommodate more blood without any increase in pressure. So we call these high compliance blood vessels. They have really low pressure in them, from anywhere from 0 to 10 millimeters of mercury. All right, so here you can see where most of the blood is in your body. And you could consider this like a reservoir of blood. So if under stressful circumstances, if you need to have a lot of blood to go to muscles because all of a sudden you start exercising your muscles, guess where that blood can come from? These small veins and venules right here, because they will constrict and then that will add that blood volume to your circulatory system. And what does that do to venous return? That increases venous return and that helps heart function right through end-diastolic volume. All right, so we're going to change tacks in just a little bit after I'll stop and entertain some questions. I'm not sure anybody can come up with any questions at the moment for a couple of reasons. Because you got a test next time that's not covering this topic, but it's also something that you have to spend some time with. All right, some quality time. Okay.
This just said that veins have been logged in the test.
Yes. I see what you're saying. Okay. It is true that conducting arteries arteries that are very close to the heart have more elastic tissue in them than muscle tissue. So when the heart pumps a lot of blood, produces that stroke volume, that big ejection fraction comes out of the heart, right? Those elastic arteries do expand. They kind of blow up like a balloon, okay? And then as the heart goes into diastole, the aorta, and those other conducting arteries with all that elastic tissue then can shrink back down and maintain blood flow. It kind of acts like a little bit of a pump, that all that elastic force is returned back to the blood and helps maintain blood flow even though the heart is relaxing. So your book is kind of right in both circumstances. In terms, but veins, I would say that arteries have more elastic tissue, but veins, especially these small veins that we were talking about that can relax and expand, those are more highly compliant. They don't need a lot of pressure to expand. All right, so both of those statements from your book is correct, but I would probably say since now we're kind of past the first chapter, that what's more important to appreciate is the veins as being able to, they're much more compliant. They can hold they can hold more blood. So they can expand more than the conducting arteries can. Okay? That's all I can say at the moment about that. So I don't have a big disagreement with your book. And we just have to talk about specific circumstances. All right, think about that. Ask me another, maybe a follow-up question. What about a follow-up question? Do you have a follow-up question? Well, about anything, because I'm about ready to change topics just a little bit. We're going to switch from talking about extrinsic and intrinsic control of cardiac output and talk about some hormonal regulation of the heart. Okay? All right, let's move on. All right? Blood and body fluid volumes. Blood volume is going to be controlled primarily by three hormones in your body. Antidiuretic hormone. Oh, tell me, what organ does antidiuretic hormone work on? Yeah, probably kidney, right? Because a diuretic works on the kidney. Aldosterone and natriuretic hormones. So here are the three hormones I want you to know something about, like where they come from, where do they act, and what's the effect on your cardiovascular system. All right, so we said that it's going to affect blood volume. How does blood volume affect your cardiovascular system? Well, we kind of talked about it in terms of the Frank Starling law right here. As your blood volume increases, what about venous return? More blood you have, more blood can flow back to the heart. And as more blood flows back to the heart, what about end diastolic volume? The end diastolic volume gets bigger, and under normal circumstances, what happens to contractility of the heart as EDV goes up? It gets stronger. Force of contraction increases because under most circumstances, all of us in here are operating in this region of the Frank Starling curve, kind of a little bit on the ascending limb, so that if we have a little bit of an increase of venous return to the heart, our heart still can get stronger to pump that blood. All right? If you're in heart failure, you're over here. Under normal circumstances, we're here so that as the end diastolic volume increases a little bit, our heart can respond and get stronger, which is a really good thing. Okay? So, that's how blood volume affects contractility of the heart via end diastolic volume because of venous return, the filling of the heart. So here are a couple of very important hormones. All right, now here's a question that I want you to answer in about a week or so. Which of the above hormones are synergistic and which are antagonistic? Is that a good thing to understand? Yeah, to have precise control of blood volume, you would expect that there should be some, antagonistic mechanisms that regulate blood volume because it's so important on what parameter? Cardiac output, right, of the heart, because it works through what? Stroke volume, because of and diastolic volume. All right, so these are really important hormones that can affect your cardiovascular system. All right, the first one, antidiuretic hormone. And you know what? We talked about this one already, so this is just a blast from the past. You should be kind of familiar with antidiuretic hormone. Released from the pituitary. What part of the pituitary? The posterior part, right? When osmoreceptors detect high osmolality in the brain or in the blood. What does high osmolality mean? High salt, which means what in terms of water? High water, low water inside your body in terms of water balance. Low water balance inside your body. So what would you expect? Should you lose more water or try to retain water? Yeah, try to retain water. Maybe dump some salt out, okay? All right, so let's take a look at this. So how might that happen? From drinking too many margaritas, right? Excess salt intake, all right, could produce that, right? That causes thirst because these osmoreceptors are in the hypothalamus that can trigger a thirst response in you, right? And that's, and also it stimulates water reabsorption from the urine, right? And as water is resorbed from the urine, what happens to your urine volume? As you absorb water from urine, what happens to urine volume? It goes down, all right? So ADH will produce a small amount of urine that is very salty as a result of that. Okay, so let's take a look at this nice, what do we got right here? What do we call this? Something that starts with a stimulus and it ends in a response. What do we call that? Yeah, that's called a response loop, and it has feedback, right? So it's a feedback loop. All right, so what's the stimulus, right? Response loops always starts with a stimulus, so now you're back again on kind of familiar ground. Once again, think of all the elements that make a response loop. All right, so dehydration, right, will decrease blood volume, or maybe excessive salt ingestion, eating too much salt, will increase blood osmolality. The saltiness of your blood will do what? Will increase. And can you see how dehydration or excess salt ingestion will increase blood osmolality? Does that make sense? Okay, you should be able to follow that. All right, so that's the stimulus. There are receptors, right? In the hypothalamus, osmoreceptors. And then the hypothalamus is going to make a decision on what to do. How would your hypothalamus want to correct that situation if your blood is too salty? Well, it's going to stimulate thirst centers, right? And usually respond by doing what? Drinking. Okay, right here, drinking. All right, and when you drink, what happens to blood volume? It goes up, right? Because you absorb that water. It goes into your cardiovascular system. How does this relate to the initial stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from it? It subtracts from it, so that's a nice, what kind of feedback loop? Negative feedback response, right? All right, so that's one thing. Let's look at this other loop over here. All right, the osmoreceptors then make a decision to increase a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. It sends it through the tract down into the posterior pituitary where those neurons release antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic hormone increases in the blood. And what will that do to urine production? Antidiuretic. Not diuretic hormone, but antidiuretic. If a diuretic makes you pee, what does an antidiuretic do? It makes you conserve water in your body. Right, so as you conserve water, as you retain water, what happens to blood volume? Yeah, blood volume goes up. How does that relate to the initial stimulus? Nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so then that puts you back into homeostasis. Okay, so that is ADH, antidiuretic hormone, but there's another name for that. It's also called vasopressin because ADH can also cause vasoconstriction of blood vessels. And you're going to see that that's a similar effect, right? What happens if we vasoconstrict veins? What happens to venous return? If vasopressin causes veins to constrict, what happens to venous return? Okay, as the veins vasoconstrict, that forces more blood back into the circulation, forces more venous return. All right. end-diastolic volume goes up, cardiac output goes up. Right? And that's the same effect as what? Increasing blood volume by retaining water in the body. All right, that's the first hormone. We're going to go back and make a synopsis of these three different hormones. All right, aldosterone. I think we probably talked about aldosterone already somewhere. What kind of hormone? What can you tell me about aldosterone? It's a steroid. Well, it says right here. Yes, where is it secreted from? Aldosterone from the adrenal cortex. Can you picture where the adrenal gland is? It's above the kidneys, not the medulla, because what's released from the medulla, adrenal medulla? Epinephrine and norepinephrine, so it's the cortical regions, and on one of the tests you even had to know what layer of the adrenal cortex aldosterone comes from. But let's not digress too much. All right, that helps maintain blood volume and pressure through reabsorption and retention of salt and water from the urine. Okay, so it causes resorption of water. And does that sound similar to antidiuretic hormone? So now you can probably answer this first question right here. Which hormones do you know already have a synergistic effect? Both aldosterone and ADH maintain blood volume by resorbing water, all right, from urine so that you don't pass so much water in urine. All right, so aldosterone is stimulated by salt deprivation, low blood volume, and low blood pressure. That's what the adrenal cortex is monitoring, right? As low, and do I have a feedback loop right here? Oh, yeah, okay, this is good. This is really good. Let me start with this, let me just talk about this figure right here, which then I'll talk about the previous slides. All right, so this slide right here might be the most important slide in the whole book. Okay, not from a purely physiological standpoint of understanding antagonistic control, which I think is the most important concept, right? Antagonistic control. But there is a pathology that's very common. And I heard a statistic today, I can't remember the statistic, that if you take diabetes, hypertension, and one other disease, it was like almost 80% of all the people in the United States have one of these three diseases. All right, so I'm thinking of a very prevalent disease process, and it's not diabetes. What's a very prevalent disease that people have? And it's kind of a silent killer because you don't know that you have this. Okay? And it is hypertension is the one I'm thinking about. Hypertension, which means what? High blood pressure. Okay. So this mechanism right here, we looked at aldosterone a little bit. Aldosterone participates in this mechanism. It's called the renin-angiotensin aldosterone mechanism or system. This is the most important mechanism for controlling blood pressure over the long term. Not from second to second, but from day to day, week to week, month to month. So if you have hypertension, guess what mechanism or system is misbehaving? It is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism that isn't operating properly in people. And so this is the mechanism that we use to adjust in people to get their blood pressure back to normal. Okay, so let's take a look at the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Now this is a really good exam figure. So if this is the most important figure in the class, guess what? This is on the test. Okay, so if we need to go over it a bunch, that's fine. Okay, I can get started today with it. All right, so this is, what are we looking at? Something that starts with a stimulus. What is that? Response loop, right? So here's a response loop. It's going to involve a number of these different factors right here. The stimulus for initiating this response loop is decreased blood pressure, which could be due to hemorrhage, right? Maybe you sweat a lot, okay? Maybe you're exercising really strenuously during a hot day or something. All right, so blood pressure decreases. You have decreased blood flow to kidneys because blood pressure is going to decrease for whatever reason. Maybe low blood volume. Maybe you're not replacing fluids inside your body. So what organ are we really interested in here in starting this mechanism off? That is a kidneys, right? So we're talking about cardiovascular function, but we got to really focus on the kidneys. So we see that we can't, you got to take like a really Eastern approach to understanding your body as opposed to Western medicine, right? Western medicine, you know, the heart pumping blood. Eastern is what? Everything is more integrated. There's an interrelationship between various organs in your body. And so here you see a nice relationship between the kidneys and cardiovascular function. All right, so there is a part of the kidneys called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. That's something that probably you wanted to just brush over when you took an anatomy class, but you might want to open up your anatomy book and find out where that juxtaglomerular apparatus is. All right. When it senses low blood pressure or blood flow to the kidneys, it's going to release an enzyme into the blood. And that enzyme is renin. So a typical kind of question, if you're just going to memorize, is where does renin come from? It comes from, yeah, somebody said a really good answer, the juxtaglomerular apparatus, but I would be happy right now if you were to say kidneys, okay? But if you want to know what part of the kidney, that's really good. All right, so renin is an enzyme, and it participates in a cascade mechanism. So it's going to activate a precursor molecule that we call angiotensinogen. And you agree with me that that's a precursor inactive molecule? Because why? Because you got ogen on there, right? All right, so angiotensinogen is converted into angiotensin. Renin is just a proteolytic enzyme that chops off a couple amino acid residues off of angiotensinogen, produces angiotensin 1. And angiotensin 1 is a fairly inactive compound. All right, it's not all that active, but it can be converted into a more active form called angiotensinogen 2. And the enzyme that converts angiotensin 1 into 2 is called angiotensin-converting enzyme. But instead of saying angiotensin-converting enzyme, what would you like to say? And everybody in the world would agree with you. They would just say ACE. Right? So ACE stands for angiotensin-converting enzyme. And that enzyme, okay, is found pretty much in the lungs. And it's found a little bit in the liver, but it's mostly in the lungs. Well, I don't have that on this slide. You might want to just jot that down. ACE is found in the lungs. Okay, so now you got angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 2 can vasoconstrict arterioles, okay, and that's going to increase blood pressure. What was the initial stimulus? Decrease blood pressure. So looking at the vasoconstrictive properties from angiotensin 2 on blood pressure, is that positive or negative feedback? And what does that produce? Positive or negative feedback? Negative feedback, because the response subtracts from the stimulus. That's negative feedback. And negative feedback, under most circumstances, produces what? A disease state or homeostasis? Homeostasis, right? So now, certainly, that is helping somebody. Okay. All right, angiotensin 2 also goes to the adrenal cortex. And it stimulates, so angiotensin 2 is not an enzyme, it's a hormone, goes to adrenal cortex because it's in the blood, it goes everywhere in the body, and that causes the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone into the blood, which then goes back to the kidneys. Where did we start with all this? We started with the kidneys, now we're back at the kidneys again, and what's the effect of aldosterone on the kidneys? It increases blood volume by decreasing urine output. Now, what's the effect, what is this response compared to the initial stimulus? Does it add or subtract? It subtracts from it. So here's another nice negative feedback loop that maintains homeostasis. Okay. So both of these mechanisms right here have a tendency to maintain blood pressure. And in some people, this blood pressure is too high. So we try to work with this mechanism through these effects over here, which we're going to talk about next time. Okay? And you've probably heard of all of these different drugs, but now we got to relate it to the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. All right, one last thing, one last question before you go. The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism is a control mechanism for what? Controlling blood pressure, in the long term. It's the most important mechanism for controlling blood pressure long term. But right now, you're all going to stand up, your blood pressure is going to drop. You're not going to use renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism because it takes days to operate. You'll be using another mechanism, which you've heard of already. It's important for regulating blood pressure in the short term, like when you change body position. What mechanism is that? That is what we call, and you'll hear it because we've talked about it already. We're going to go over it again. That's the baroreceptor reflex, baroreceptor reflex, like right now when you stand up. Yeah, I think we did. But we'll go over it again to make sure that you have it. Okay, sign in sheet, please. All right, so I'll be ready next time.